Welcome to Total Network Operations, the podcast dedicated to hardworking network operators like you who deliver all the packets and leverage your own actual intelligence. Here on the TNOps podcast, we address org and process issues, trends in the evolving NetOps tech stack, vendor solutions geared for operations, and how it all needs to work together. Our goal is to shine a bright light on best practices in NetOps so you can take away useful ideas and make informed decisions for your network. I'm your friendly neighborhood internet plumber, Scott Robon. On today's episode, artificial intelligence, AI. The buzz is high and the hype is deep. Now, the arrival of ChatGPT for the masses in November 2022, almost 2 years ago now, really started this next tech arms race. This, other chat-based tools, and the focus on integrating AI and ML have all been around long enough now to produce some utility for NetOps, but it's also been around long enough to see limitations and to figure out there is hype that needs to be burned through. Today, we're going to get a little smarter with the secret decoder ring on AI, the next level of detailed terminology, and where we see things going with AI tooling embedded in products for enhanced functions and performance. And whatever we say today, we'll need to update in 4 to 6 months. We have a very special guest today on TNOps, Phil Gervasi, the Director of Technical Evangelism at Kentik. Phil's presence here today holds twofold importance for me. Point number one, in January 24, Phil helped give TNOps a voice by being the very first channel to take a risk on me getting these ideas out here. So Phil, thank you for that. I definitely owe you. And Phil has been parsing the language around AI for quite some time, and I mean years. And he's had some really helpful guidance on what's going on with AI, what's just math behind the scenes, and what's other. So Phil, great to have you here today. Tell us more about yourself and your journey to how you got where you are.
Hey, Scott, thanks very much. And thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. I think you accentuated the word very a little bit too much as far as very important or very impactful. But I will take that compliment. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Now, all great. So now I will start by saying some of your audience might know me already, but as far as my background, I was a traditional network engineer for about 15 years. I did start off in the help desk, got into more broad systems. So I have significant experience pushing group policy in Windows and spinning up VMs and managing ESXi back when it was pretty new. But then getting very, very deep specifically into networking, chasing all the latest and greatest Cisco certifications mostly. Getting then into pre-sales engineering because I wanted to get away from overnight cutovers and absolutely loved that. I loved interfacing with customers in that capacity, doing presentations. And because of my high school teacher background that I had prior to getting into tech, and then and then seeing that sort of come to fruition as a pre-sales engineer, I transitioned into my current position, being a technical evangelist with a different company, but going into technical evangelism, which I do differentiate from technical marketing. In any case, I've been doing technical evangelism for almost 4 years now, and as soon as I got into this space, and again with a different vendor, what I noticed was there was a need to sort of demystify some of these terms and concepts, specifically around machine learning. AI, AI ops was very rarely heard 4 or 5 years ago, at least in my circles, right? And that was the idea was, okay, what's going on with this machine learning stuff? So I started to research it heavily, which by the way, I do believe is one of the primary roles of a technical evangelist is to research and learn and understand new technology and then be able to turn around and instruct, teach, present, do workshops on that kind of thing. And that's exactly what I did. And I've been very focused on that, among other things, of course, because my company is focused on network observability. So there are other aspects that I need to look at, but machine learning, artificial intelligence has been a very big part of my life over the past few years because of that. And because of its significance that we're seeing today in IT operations and specifically in network operations where I focus. So that has been my journey specifically in the context of this podcast, a little bit of my career journey as well.
Perfect. Well, having come with some operational background and thinking about AI in the context of networking constructs and all that, I think it
you know, you're a perfect candidate to help us navigate some of this. Let me tee up a little more of the context for why I asked you to do this. You know, besides being a great speaker and being well known, you know, Phil and I are both involved with an organization called the U.S. Networking User Association. You might hear of the local NUGs or network user groups. And Phil and I are leaders in respective groups. I think Phil does about 18 within New York State. I'm only really involved with the Virginia NUG. Sorry, not 18, but I don't know how you do it all, man. We both have kind of seen the questions develop around AI. And we had this idea a short while ago that maybe it's time to start providing, you know, more primer type information to help people go beyond those surface level questions and think, you know, stop thinking that AI is just ChatGPT. There's so much more going on here. And so that's kind of the motivation for doing this here today with a special eye for what impact this will have on operations in particular. And by the way, Phil and I love the NUGs. USNUA is a great organization. Go find and check out a NUG near you, usnua.com, and you'll see the different groups out there. So let's get into the meat. You know, AI is not new. Phil's going to talk to that, I'm sure. It has many underlying pieces of technology. You know, there's math, there's statistics, there's regression analysis, and there's more. Phil's going to take us on how to parse this and understand what's really new and what's just really been developing for some time. So why don't we start with key concepts up top, you know, generative AI versus general AI. Let's start there.
Okay. So before actually defining those terms, let me get even more broad and say that the term artificial intelligence, like you said, is not new. But though we see it now very much being used even in mainstream news, mainstream popular culture. So it feels new. It is not. However, it is something that has changed in recent days that makes it more relevant. So there have been changes that have occurred in recent days that we're going to discuss in today's episode that actually show why we're talking about it now. It's not just because it became marketing hype out of nowhere. There is a reason, a technical reason.
But before I inserted the ChatGPT reference there mm-hmm. on purpose, yeah. right? That yep. that was a huge eye-opening event for many of us. But yeah, keep going.
Actually, that's very good because ChatGPT, which is the chat user interface in front of the GPT model, which you know was being developed in the 2010s, teens, and then we saw it in the early 2020s. Was based on some technology that came out in the mid 20 teens and then 2017 with a specific technology that we're going to discuss today. So it is that new in the sense of the transition from an old way to do artificial intelligence and specifically large language models in the way we do it today. But the term artificial intelligence, I want it to be very clear that it is a broad umbrella term that refers to, there's a variety of technologies. A lot of it is math. There's a lot of workflows and data analysis and statistical analysis, machine learning. All of that is part and parcel of this umbrella term artificial intelligence. Many folks will say that AI is the process, the desire, the practice of getting computers, machines to think and behave like human beings. I think many, especially today, very, very modern data analysts and folks working in the AI space would take issue with that because we really want to do it better than human beings. And that also presupposes that we all have it figured out, that we know how human beings think. I have a good friend of mine who has a PhD in neuroscience, and he'll be the first one to say, we don't really know exactly what's right. going on in there.
Yep.
But certainly, the idea is that there is contextual awareness, there is a situational awareness, an ability to interact with a human being and have that discourse. So in that sense, or to be able to synthesize data, to be able to analyze data, all those things that we would normally attribute to human intelligence, whatever that is, to a computer, to a machine. That's how broad AI is. So when you hear the term AI ops, well, that's kind of what we're doing. How are we applying this concept of being able to analyze data, to synthesize data, to operations? So we have a couple of terms, generative AI, general AI. There are others as well. There's weak AI, for example, which some would make synonymous with generative. Well, starting with general AI. General AI is emphasizing the data analysis part. Yes, it's heavy math. We're recognizing patterns in data. The data might be, you know, words and texts like a large language model. It might be data coming from your network. It might be telemetry coming from your aircraft, literally like in the aerospace industry or the biomedical industry, looking at data from MRIs and trying to look at patterns of among cancer patients, all sorts of data. And then there's in that process, the general AI models under the hood would be like machine learning models that will cluster data and look for what will classify data. And you'll start to hear about terms like supervised and unsupervised learning. But it is primarily focused with that data analysis to produce some sort of result. As opposed to generative AI, which Gen AI, as many people call it today, which is really what the buzz is all about, especially when we talk about natural language processing and large language models. Now, generative AI, there is absolutely a component of data analysis, but it's more focused on the generation of new information. So if you think about summarizing a text and then spitting out a summary of it, creating a new image, doesn't have to be text-based, new video. For those of us in working in technology, spitting out a new configuration, spitting out new code. When I say spitting, I mean, I say that with tongue in cheek, actually generating it based on analyzing text. So there is overlap between generative AI and general AI, generative and general, in the sense that there are similar models in analyzing data, but what are we using them for? Now, natural language processing is this concept of being able to interact with a human being, a computer, being able to act with a human being in a natural way. Now, I mean, you can probably go back to the 1940s and 1950s when we were using machine, or rather assembly language and other machine languages, things before there was a Python, or Go or things like that. And if you got really good at it, it might feel natural to you where you can interface with a computer in that way. Natural language processing is bringing that to the next level where you can actually have discourse with a computer, but ultimately with the data behind the computer in a very natural human language kind of way. But beyond just giving the computer instructions like you would in a programming language. So conversationally, imagine context, sentiment analysis, inference, subtext and pretext, biases that are all there in the complexity of human language. And Scott, a conversation between you and me. Not only that, remembering some things about you from previous conversations. So there is some kind of foundational knowledge.
That's
very
context.
Different than just... Yeah. Context. Yep. Very different than programming in Python.
For sure. I know we'll get into this more later, but it seems like the ability to have a natural language interface, even by itself, even though it's not necessarily only AI, it's very helpful, right? There are things that you can do with that have made, you know, interaction and manipulating large amounts of data very easy. And if I remember my history, wasn't there the ELISA program in the 50s or 60s that tried to be one of those, pass the Turing test? You couldn't mm-hmm. tell if ELISA was a real person or a program. Mm-hmm. That's obviously reared its head again. So, but mm-hmm. yeah, please continue. I think next on the list, we wanted to talk about what is a large language model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So large language models or LLMs are, I consider them a subset of natural language processing, though some disagree, but certainly they're related. So we can leave it at that. A large language model is that endeavor of natural language processing and generative AI and all the math and all of the data analysis and telemetry pipelines that goes into a specific model that analyzes text data and then produces text result. Now, today, we're seeing that text also in audio form, but ultimately, it is text data, that kind of information. And so the advances over the past 50, 60, 70 years have been significant in going from very focus on syntax, grammar, next word prediction, understanding that stuff, to today, understanding, like you said, context, understanding sentiment and inferring pretext and subtext. So the sophistication has increased significantly over the past 50, 60, 70 years to make that discourse more natural. But that's all part and parcel of the concept of the large language model. And we get there through model training. Now, model training or pre-training is the activity of training that large language model in some gigantically expensive data center to get it so that way the results are accurate enough for you to say, this thing is ready to go, let's start using it. We call that being fit for service. And that's what we mean by model training. And I wanted to point that out now, Scott, because that is something that I've noticed. Folks will say, we're using this model and then we're training the model. And I'm like, you're not training any models. You know, OpenAI already did that. Now, you are certainly doing some fine tuning maybe, and you are adding some industry specific data after the fact. And we're going to talk about why and how that works, of course, but you're not doing that pre-training again. The pre-training can take months and can cost hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, and the very hardware intensive as well.
Lots of cycles on many GPUs that have their own interconnection and internetworking requirements. Mm-hmm. And that's a separate topic for another time, right?
Yeah. And as we get into what's happening and understanding AI, understanding the mechanisms, the technology, we'll get into why it's so computationally expensive and why it costs so much as well.
Sure. You did call out training versus pre-training. Is there a hair to split there that you want to make clear?
So forgive me if my terms are maybe not in line with every other person out there, every other talking head, but I'll use the terms and define them for you here. When we start to put a large language model together, we build our data center, we have our GPU set up and everything is networked. What we do is we select hyperparameters ahead of time, meaning we select certain functions, certain algorithms ahead of time, certain weights, whatever. We set that ahead of time with our best guess based on the kind of data, based on the kind of outputs that we want. So those are called hyperparameters. They're static, set by an engineer. Although today they're going to be set and then adjusted by the AI workflow itself. And then we're going to ingest a tremendous amount of data in order to analyze it, and then and teach the model, and we'll talk about how models learn, how we teach them. Now, that process of ingesting data, we need to scrub it, we need to qualify it, make sure it's accurate. We need to do things to it so that way it's normalized. And I'm going to start talking about machine learning terms here. Transformed, standardized, scaled, all of that happens here. Basically, I guess what you could call typical machine learning pre-processing, which is critical, which is absolutely critical for any ML workflow, but specifically in this context of large language models and AI. That's how we produce those results. All that's happening as well. Then we're going to start to apply those models and algorithms. There might be neural networks and deep learning, which we're going to define today, happening there. That produces some sort of result. This is all the training period, okay? This may take weeks or months, and it produces some sort of result. We look at that result, and then through a process of a cost function, gradient analysis, all those kind of things, we say, this result is bad. And so, of course, a lot of this is programmatic and happens autonomously, but certainly analysts and researchers are looking at it as well. And fine-tuning those hyperparameters, going back and saying, let's adjust those biases, let's adjust some of those weights, let's adjust some of those hyperparameters, and then the system itself will adjust the autonomous hyperparameters, which we call just parameters. Those are the ones that are changed automatically to make that cost function better, a better result. Once we get to a point, and so it's kind of a loop, right? You can imagine there's an input into the system. It goes through your multiple layers of your neural network. You get a result, you don't like it, or the system doesn't like it. It goes back, it adjusts the parameters, goes through an input. And it's just doing this loop over and over until you get results that are acceptable. This is very high level stuff, right? We're not getting to what does it mean to be acceptable? But again, it's related to the process of gradient descent in a cost function. So mathematically, is this accurate enough to where we could say it's fit for service? When that time comes, we stop that training process. It's done. We say that the model is fit for service, and then we can make it available to use. You can augment that later on with additional data, which we call a RAG pipeline. We'll talk about later to make it industry specific, for example. And of course, you can go back and retrain your model and adjust it, update it with new data and all those things after the fact. But that initial training, where those parameters are initialized in the first place, that is what I'm talking about by the pre-training, which again,
gotcha.
Many months and involving a very expensive computationally and cost-wise and power-wise data center to do. So it's not a trivial task whatsoever. Running the model, you can do on your laptop because you're just feeding your data, you know, what your query, it runs it and it spits out some information. You're not doing anything super computationally expensive. Although you might incorporate that model into your own workflow, so you can increase the scope of what you're doing on your laptop, where you're running your own kind of like mini AI workflow using a third party like OpenAI or Meta or Google or whatever.
Right. But is it safe to say when a new version of ChatGPT comes out, that model has been trained or pre-trained in the terms that you've just used here?
That's right.
That's all been done. And now I'm using it. And then there's some incremental fine tuning that can happen over time. But that's, we'll get into that as we go here for sure. So
that's correct. Yeah. And so when you hear folks talking about like a vendor, for example, say we trained our LLM, and I'm like, wait a minute, did you? Or are you using someone else's LLM on the back end? And then you know, they have an open API that you can hook into and then utilize that for the language component, right? So think about a company that has a bunch of data from aircraft, right? And so they have that data they're inputting and they have it in some data lake. They have this data set. But the data set doesn't know English, doesn't know how to process my query, which is written in human language or, in my case, English. So you can leverage an LLM like an OpenAI, like GPT really is the model, GPT-4, Omni right now, I think is the latest. And that can be that language interface. But it references your data set of information, telemetry that you ingested from the various aircraft in your fleet. So now it has contextual awareness as well. So that's really how a lot of this is happening out there in the world right now. Because again, one of these data centers can be in the billions of dollars with a B and a large physical footprint. The investment is tremendous and you're not going to see a return on it for quite some time. And so for a Silicon Valley startup to say we built an LLM, I mean, that's unlikely that they built their own LLM. They probably built a very interesting workflow that integrates with another LLM. Though, of course, I don't know what everybody's doing right now.
Yeah, we don't claim to have an exhaustive survey of what every AI startup or everyone who's using AI is actually doing here.
So, right, and it does not preclude that what they're doing isn't interesting or useful or good. Just being accurate and correct in the way we think about things, I think, is important.
Right. And there's another whole set of conversation, below the surface of this iceberg in terms of what I can do with different public cloud services and using different models and doing, that incremental training. I just went to a recent AWS summit in Washington, D.C. and got blasted with, the whole bring your own model discussion. And there's lots of other capability there. It's going to take a lot to parse through it and figure out how to use it all. And of course, like cloud services, you pay on consumption. You're not building that expensive data center with all your GPUs. You're using their services. Could still cost you a lot of money depending on how intensive the training is.
Yeah, right. So now,
you wanted to make a distinction. You always do between AI and machine learning, and some of the AI mechanisms that are buried in there. Why don't you speak to that for a bit? Mm-hmm.
Sure. Well, again, AI is that broad term, and so the machine learning algorithms and models that we use are the mechanisms, the technical mechanisms that get us there, that get us to that human-like intelligence or that human-like discourse ability, if that's even possible, but you understand what I mean. AI is the broad term, and ML, among other things, are the technical means of getting there. So it's not just ML. So I would refrain from saying AI/ML because ML kind of falls under AI, but so do the statistical analysis algorithms and formulas that you learned as a second year college student and third year college student, which I didn't because I shifted from business to English. So my last statistics class was a freshman in college. But so does also dealing with data and having that all the different workflows and all that. All of that is part and parcel of this umbrella of AI technology. And that's why I make that distinction. And so it to me, once you start to break down, okay, what's really happening with AI? And earlier in your introduction, you joked that, well, it's just all math. Well, it kind of is. It's very simple math. very complex algorithms, but it's also, of course, the workflows of data pipelines and all that we're doing in the entire workflow, not just individual algorithms. But generative AI and large language models specifically, and I think you probably should focus on natural language processing and large language models moving forward. It's considered probabilistic in the sense that we're looking at what is the likelihood that this next, what is the most probable next word in this sentence or next four sentences in this conversation. So it's probabilistic in that sense, which is in contrast to how things started many, many years ago when it was based on syntax and grammar rules. So in the 1950s, there was this endeavor, the IBM Georgetown experiment, to translate Russian into English, or was it English into Russian? I don't remember, but it was 60 sentences that was translated. And it was basically dictionary lookup, very sophisticated at the time. And there was this idea, because the field of computer science at the time was brand new, that, well, we just need to focus on grammar and syntax. And that's also, we're getting a little metaphysical here, was also there's also some ideas there that, well, that's what knowledge is. It's really just the collection of words to represent the ideas that are in your head. So for those of you that read like Foucault and Derrida and things like that, you know, it's like the sign and the signifier, and that your word is a symbol of an idea in your head, which is actually in turn a symbol of this universal concept. And so folks were trying to figure out like, well, then what is knowledge? What is understanding and learning and that sort of thing. And you had eventually this progression to something called computational theory of language. You might be familiar with Noam Chomsky.
Yep.
Not related to large language models today, but it was this idea of looking at how we can model a discourse between humans and how we can generate new information, a computer can generate new information. So all that's happening decade after decade after decade. And the goal today, you know, not even that long ago, 20 years ago, so not even today, you know, we started to see things like your text editor, whatever on your phone, being able to like predict your next word, spell check. Then you had the rise of simple chat bots that do not understand your sentiment, but they can have some sort of rudimentary conversation with you. The focus today is making that really, really human-like interaction. So the, again, sentiment analysis, inferring subtext, understanding bias, and having that conversation with you and remembering what you were talking about. So that way there's a growing context. That's very different than what early LLMs were based on n-gram models, for example. An n-gram model, n is the signifier for the number of words in a sequence. N-gram model doesn't have to be words, but let's use words as our example. An n-gram model says, well, based on this number of words in this sequence, the next word is probably going to be this, n minus one.
And a completely probabilistic analysis.
Yeah, yeah. And so we haven't moved away from that entirely, but we've augmented it with other technologies to make it more accurate and to give greater context. So we don't use n-gram models anymore. Now, what we're doing as of 2017, we're using something called attention, self-attention, and the technical mechanism is called a transformer. And this is kind of what changed the game, along with hardware, which we're going to discuss in a moment.
This isn't a cartoon discussion, Transformers.
No, no, so, it is not a transformer. What happens is attention or self-attention, and this idea came out in a paper in 2017 called Attention is All You Need, was the idea that if we assign weights to the words and phrases and then put them into not a relational database necessarily, but we represent them in 3D vector space, we can see how things are related to each other, and we can assign importance to certain words and phrases, and therefore move away from just saying, these are the 8 words I have in a sentence, this is the most probable next word. Now we can say, no, we have a greater understanding of context. Of course, you can expand this to many words. We're talking about huge data sets, not just a sentence. And that changed the face of it really revolutionized large language models, natural language processing in general, and it really kickstarted, I think, where we are today with large language model technology. But it really was the confluence of several things. It was that, but also how data became so readily available. In 1996, the internet was just this burgeoning thing, and so what data did you use in your data set? Well, whatever digital library you had at your university. So it was largely an academic endeavor with a few companies like IBM and things like that you know, messing around with stuff. Today, we have the internet. And so you have a tremendous amount of data, regardless of whether you think that's good or bad, like the quality of the data. There, it's there. We have the internet.
Lots of content that could just be sucked in.
Yeah, that can be sucked in. And we have other information as well, you know, private. But in any case, we have this incredible data set or incredible size data set of diversity of data, of volume of data that we can train these models on. And we also have a difference in scale in hardware. You can think of nanotechnology changing over the past few decades, where we were, you know, talking about how many, you know, the size, what are we down to, like to 3 nanometer chip? I'm not exactly sure where we are right now, but the amount of horsepower that you can fit on silicon today is very different than it used to be. And so just the advancement of computational power, and that happened alongside that. And what also happened was the advancement in like actual speeds and feeds in the network. And so, you know, going from 10 meg to 100 meg to gig, and then all of a sudden, very quickly to 25, 40, 100. And now we're looking at 800 gig in data centers. And, you know, there's obviously discussion of going into 1.2, 1.6 terabits per second. This is, you know, big speeds and feeds, the development of what's called scheduled fabrics, where we have beyond lossless connectivity, which, you know, we really wanted in data centers anyway. Now we have actual packet schedulers. All of this technology happening in similar kind of a similar time allows us to do what we're doing today, processing large language models with huge data sets and doing it in such a way where it's accurate and it doesn't take forever. So it might take months, but that is still within the realm of usefulness. And right. So we can, you know, we have this technology today because of that. And there's an entire workflow that happens that perhaps we'll get into of how the data is ingested, what do we do with it, and how do we produce the result?
There is a term that I think you've just narrowly avoided here, but I think it's important on what is a token and what is tokenization. Can you tease that out for us?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I would like to mention before I do, though, that there was a time when this was an academic endeavor, and that's not really the case anymore. I mean, it is, of course. Yeah, Cornell and MIT. I mean, these sure. universities are still working on it. But if you're going to build a $1.5 billion data center to do something, and that's a hard sell for some of these academic institutions. So we're seeing a lot of this happen in private labs owned by web scale companies and familiar names. So that's kind of where a lot of this research and development is happening right now as a result.
Yep.
Now, tokenization is very important, and it's used a couple different ways in the world of AI. So there might be some confusion, but we're going to start with this. Let's go back to the n-gram model, right? An n-gram is going to be a sequence of consecutive items, words. So the quick brown fox is an example that I used in a paper that I wrote a few months ago. The quick brown fox is 4 words. The quick is a bigram, 2 words. The quick brown, that's a trigram. Just the word the is a unigram. Well, when you ingest text data into computers, it doesn't really know English like we know English. It needs to translate that into something that it can compute in math. So what it's going to do is take that sentence, it's going to tokenize it, it's going to create individual chunks of data that it can do something with. This is the process of tokenization. And then once it is tokenized, whether that is word tokenization, like individual words or individual characters, including punctuation, you have to make some decisions as to what do I do with contractions? Is don't one token or is it two? Or what do I do with that? So there's some interesting stuff that happens there. And then we embed those tokens into, well, it's called embeddings. We translate those tokens into actual numerical form that a computer can use in math. That numerical form, those embeddings are going to exist, well, for a computer, they're going to exist in tables, but in your imagination, in your mind's eye, you can imagine them existing in like a 3D dimensional space. And that's very important, because if anyone remembers Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, Khan did not remember 3D space. And so he did not remember the Z-axis, but we do what we do. And it's very important because now you can establish relationships among words. Because that's what we're talking about with large language models. All this process can happen with other kinds of data, but certainly we're talking about language right now. So if you can think of words like amazing, terrific, good, nice, wonderful, they're all related to each other. So they would appear close to each other in this 3D realm. Whereas incredibly bad, worse, horrible, those are gonna appear closer to each other. But there might be some closeness and crossover and things like that. So very interesting stuff. And this is how we start, a machine can start to build understanding when you give it an input and it kind of starts to understand what you're saying. It really is happening in math down at the lowest levels. So once we have this process of tokenization complete, we have different types of, today, we're not using n-grams, we're using different types of neural networks and deep learning in order to produce an output, a result. And that output might be a new text, it might be a prediction, if it's more of a data analysis thing, some kind of a baseline that you're creating, if you're creating a baseline out of statistics, things like that. Some very common neural network models that you should be aware of are RNNs, recurrent neural network, which are ultimately designed to handle sequences of data. They're very commonly used in text. We use LSTM, long short-term memory, to kind of address some of the issues with recurrent neural networks. Recurrent neural networks have sort of like this long-term dependency problem. Again, because sequences of text can be, you know, millions and millions and millions of characters and words. So long short-term memory, LSTM networks are a type of RNN that address that problem. For video, audio, well, I guess just video and images and stuff, we have something called CNNs, convolutional neural networks. And then, of course, transformers, which I mentioned earlier, which is a very, very important technology. Transformers are the technology that language models like GPT and BERT use, for example. And again, they are built on the idea of the attention mechanism, which is really, really the key for why we are where we are today.
So the results aren't always great, right? And we get hallucinations. Explain how hallucinations are formed and produced. What's happening when a model hallucinates?
Sure. So the term hallucination is used usually to refer to an error in the output, or maybe just a nonsensical answer. So it's not just that it's inaccurate, it just makes no sense, which is also inaccurate, but you can have an answer that's logical, grammatically correct, and it sounds good, it's just inaccurate. If you said, what is 2 + 2? And it said, the answer to the question of 2 + 2 = 5. So it was a nice grammatically correct sentence, but with an incorrect answer. So that is a problem. It has been a problem, but it's an addressable problem. So it really comes down to data. It comes down to the process of training in the first place, and it refers to the this notion of backpropagation that makes those corrections in the model training period prior to it being fit for service. So we start off with this input layer I said earlier in training, and it goes through all of the hidden layers. So this is what a neural network looks like. And it could be multiple layers, dozens of layers between the input and the output. Each layer is going to have an input from the previous layer and an output to the next layer, all the way to the result. The result doesn't look right. We use a process of backpropagation to adjust those parameters and hyperparameters to produce a better result. Doing that properly will result in fewer hallucinations when your model is fit for service. If you do not train your model properly or for sufficient time, you can have a model that you say is ready to go and people consume, but it produces inaccurate information, inaccurate results. That's one. Ensuring the quality of the input data is very important. So where is your data coming from, and do you have sufficient data? There's this concept of model underfitting and overfitting. If you don't have enough data and you're making generalizations based on a limited data set, you know, your generalizations are going to be incorrect, and vice versa. There's problems with the training that we need to address that will result ultimately in fewer hallucinations and a more accurate result. You also need to retrain a model from time to time. Now, I don't mean retrain as in they're done. So OpenAI is done training the model, you're consuming it, and you're retraining the model. You're not retraining GPT. They retrain their own model, and they're going to do that from time to time. Hence, we had GPT 3.5, then we had GPT 4, and then GPT 4 Omni right now. Was there a 4.5? No, there was Omni.
Not yet.
Yeah. Not yet. Okay. But you get the idea. And what happens is when folks are, these organizations are retraining their model, they may be adding many more parameters that can, therefore, you have more knobs to tweak and turn to create more accurate results. So for example, there are models now that are operating with tens of billions or hundreds of billions, billions with a B, parameters, things that can be adjusted to produce a more accurate result. Hence, training taking many months. There are things that you can adjust. Some of those parameters, for example, would be something like, you have weights, you have biases, you have temperature. Temperature is an interesting one because of a story that I mentioned on a different podcast, actually. But at AutoCon Zero, I was just starting to get into this stuff, right? I was already familiar with ML and some, you know, I knew what linear regression was, right? But I wasn't super familiar with AI stuff and LLMs. So somebody is speaking, I forget who it was. Somebody's on the stage talking about large language models. And I piped up in the NAF Slack about how, oh, we can just fix hallucinations by adjusting the temperature. And I thought that was like it. That was the answer. I'm so smart. Because I just read about it like 3 days earlier or something. Well, somebody piped up in Slack and very professionally, very friendly, corrected me and said, well, I mean, temperature is a legitimate thing to adjust, but no, that's not how you fix all hallucinations. And I'm like, who is this guy? So I looked him up and I'm like, oh, he's an experienced veteran network engineer, a professional data science with an advanced degree. And he wrote a book on this stuff. So I went out and read his book. And that was actually the beginning for me to get much, much more focused on researching and being technically accurate with some of these things, including how to deal with hallucinations. So temperature is something kind of like on a sliding scale. You can adjust it so you basically reduce or increase the model's capacity to give you something a little bit wacky. And so you can increase the temperature to, you know, above zero to give it, the model will have more freedom to choose words and phrases that might not quite fit, but hence you get that more like creative aspect or the inverse of that. So temperature is something that you could certainly adjust as one of the parameters, many different types of parameters, but it is not the end-all solution for addressing hallucinations. Now today, we're also interacting with these large language models. So we have things like prompt engineering. And though I don't know if you want to call that fine tuning or not, but there is a way to over time interact with the large language model to give it the, in your discourse with the UI, get the results that you want that are more accurate or more in line with what you're looking for. And it will learn from that as well because it understands certain things about you.
I think that's the new Google hacking. Right. Mm-hmm. Remember when you wanted to put in the right search string and to get the exact one website you were looking for? I think this is a modern analogy to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is that if your training data is just the internet, I mean, that's, I say just like with air quotes, that's big text data.
Yep.
But if you're training your model on just text data, right? And so you have like Wikipedia, you have all the different online texts, you have university stuff, great. You're also looking at things like Reddit and other chats to learn a little bit about how human discourse works. Not that you're looking for accuracy with Reddit, but you're looking for how does human interaction work. So you have all this information, but you don't necessarily know anything about my network. You don't have that data. And so if you ask right now, you go into ChatGPT or your favorite large language model, right? And you ask it a question about your network, it's not going to know the answer. And maybe it'll try to produce an answer, but the answer will be incorrect. And so another aspect of it's, I guess this is not hallucinations, but it's just making your interaction with large language models more accurate and relevant for you, is to augment that large language model after the fact in the workflow with industry specific or very, very specific context. You want to limit the context window of its answer. So it's using the large language model for the actual like interaction with you in English, right? Articles and verbs and adverbs, right? Okay, great. Understanding what you're saying, the natural language processing component. But then it's got to do something with that. It's got to actually look at some sort of data set. And you say, hey, by the way, use this data set to answer the question. So the large language model is going to have agents that are able to then query. It might be a simple matter of taking your input and then behind the scenes translating that like my company does and some of our competitors into an SQL query, and then filter the data set, get that result and then put that back into regular language and then give you the answer in regular language. And it does it very, very quickly. So really, really cool stuff, but then you ensure more accurate results. I don't know how far we're going to get into how we use this technology in operations and IT operations, network operations, but certainly that is a very important piece of that.
We'll hold that thought and we'll come back to it. On hallucinations in particular, mm-hmm. it seems like there is a very common problem of creating references to websites, court cases, and things that don't exist. How do you explain those results in the context of everything you've just described about hallucinations here?
Yeah, it's spitting out information that it thinks you want to know. I mean, it doesn't think in that sense, but it's putting together like probabilistic a model of like, these are the words that I should be giving you now that sort of makes sense. It's grammatically correct, but it's not factually correct. And so that's why you have industry-specific large language models as well that would be more correct, that address some of those issues. Like, for example, there's a Casehold. It's a large language model trained on regular text, of course, but also legal text. And that's very challenging to do. It's not like that's a simple thing. It's not a trivial matter, but it addresses some of those problems that you had with, you know, just incorrect information. And the same thing with the medical field. There's BioBERT and MedPalm, developed as medical and biomedical industry for the medical and biomedical industry. In IT, and perhaps we'll talk about this at another time, there's OWL, O-W-L, created specifically for the IT industry. So it includes that lexicon and some of the more advanced information related to our field, IT, I guess more broadly, and IT operations, so that, you know, you're not getting back ridiculous answers. So the answer that large language model let's stick with English. It understands the grammar. It understands what you're trying to say. And then it's just going to give you some answer. If it doesn't have the context, the limited context window. And this is going to sound counterintuitive, but that's actually what you want to do to get a more accurate answer without underfitting, overfitting. You know, you want to limit your context window. You want to limit your data set to that which is most relevant and accurate. And not have, you know, this is something that I learned just recently, a few months ago. I always assumed, oh, you want a bigger data set. Not necessarily. You want a more accurate and relevant data set is what it is.
So Phil, on that OWL model that you've talked about, you've done it. Now you've touched mm-hmm. on something that's being specifically trained and designed for IT and IT operations. Let's, as we try to wrap up this episode, tell us a little more about that and how you see that being applied in ops types of functions.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, we're going to talk about IT ops, but just imagine in your mind's eye how this applies to any industry. I talked about biomedical, it could be finance, it could be, law, whatever industry. There is going to be this subset of data that's very, very specific, very, very relevant, that is important for the large language model to query in order to give you accurate information to analyze as well. And that's what's going on with OWL, though a lot of folks aren't using OWL. I only mention it as an example. So what I'll do is talk about it a little bit more broadly. Now that we have a large language model that we can utilize, because we're not going to build our own, what we're going to do is have our own data set on the side that our large language model will then reference. And our data set in IT operations could be all the telemetry that we're ingesting from our networks and our servers and cloud logs and, from endpoints, whatever is important to us from the global routing table, all this stuff related to IT, from our ticketing system, from logs, because remember, we can parse language here. We're not just talking about numbers. We are talking about a large language model ingesting text. Events like Windows events, you can ingest all of that. And you could start to identify patterns, identify a correlation. Although I do want to say, we didn't talk about it today, there is a difference between identifying correlation in math, using like a correlation coefficient and saying mm-hmm. these things are likely related, and then inferring that it's a causal relationship. You can't really infer causation in data per se. That requires a third party, usually a human being.
Correlation does not prove causation.
That's correct. But it is interesting. And so that's why some organizations will find correlation, put all these things in a time series and say, all these things happen at the same time. This change in your BGP peer, at the same time, you had a spike in latency over here. And over here, you had a spike in DNS resolution time. Like, well, that's interesting. All those three things happen at the same time. Perhaps they're related. And then we go and figure it out. But that's the power of using this technology in IT operations, is that we are able to interrogate data much more efficiently, much faster than ever before. If you can imagine poring over logs, poring over just regular telemetry coming from routers, switches, firewalls, you know, your containers up in the cloud, your flow logs from the cloud, all this information coming in, how do you do that manually? Even if you have an entire team, this is a way to augment an engineer, not necessarily replace, because I just explained to you that we're not quite there yet, where it's doing things like inferring causality. It's doing some of the clue chaining for you, sure, but it's doing a lot of that root cause analysis for you. You're able to interrogate the data en masse much more quickly. So instead of pivoting from data set to data set or platform to platform, you can have a large language model do that for you. Now, one of the things
there's
that
a, there's, going- a da- there's an element of data reduction there, right? That's where I feel like that, you know, the volume of telemetry that you can produce exceeds the limits of human capability, right? And this seems like a really practical, useful tool.
Yeah, well, data reduction is something that happens with large language models, period, aside from the IT industry anyway, because we're trying to say, how do I save money and time in training my model, regardless of its IT telemetry, it's just text data. And so you're going to do things like find spots where there's repeated data, deduplication is going to happen, so mundane things like that. And then also grouping, where like these things go together, let's treat it as one object. So there is a process of data reduction that happens very, very much so. But there's also a process of data reduction that happens specifically to IT operations when we're applying, you know, that large language model is doing other things. There's other stuff that's happening in under the hood in that neural network. Some of those nodes and neurons are using like clustering algorithms, right? That say these things go together. Now treat it as one group. So these events that happen, these tickets that all came in, all relate to one problem. Treat it as one group. And so now you've reduced data, and you're able to query data even that much more quickly. And what's interesting is that also helps to identify patterns. All these things are related to each other. So there's a lot of really neat stuff that can happen there specifically for our industry. It also changes the way that we can interact with data, because now, you know, me, let's say I'm not a network engineer, I can go and ask a question in human, you know, English into the system about networking stuff. Like, why is this application running so poorly in Chicago? You know, my Chicago office, obviously, it's a little more specific question than that. And it can say latency is seen to have spiked between this router and this router. And the application goes over that. So I don't know, maybe that's the cause, right? And so you're able to democratize the access to this data for the IT industry in a very, very new and I think really powerful way. That's going to change things a lot. And so moving forward, what does that mean? It just, you know, it means that we can ensure, you know, good application delivery, a good user experience. We can ensure better uptime, all those kind of things. And so, you know, are we solving new problems? No, it's kind of like the same problem that we're solving with this new technology, applying it to really make things better.
Well, let me pull at a couple of specifics there. So just in the realm of telemetry, you know, I know you know at least a little bit about that. What if I have SNMP still turned on in my network, as most networks do. I'm also using syslog. I have NetFlow, and maybe I have gRPC. You know, and I have, they're all syntactically very different. Would I use a single model to help me parse and process all of that? Would I need different models? What does that look like on the back end?
So kind of depends on what you mean by model, because within your large language model, you may be using different neural network models, right? So you're using a recurrent neural network, you're using a transformer model. So you're going to be using those different models. You're going to be using machine learning models that you're familiar with, like a linear regression model and various time series models to identify trends and anomalies. So all those models are happening under the umbrella of your large language model that you're training. Does that make sense?
It does.
So that's an important distinction there in the term. You are using those individual models and algorithms as part of training your large language model as a whole, your GPT or your BERT or your whatever, your POM.
So would a model creator train that model on those, you know, four different types of telemetry with different syntax, et cetera? Or could I divide and conquer and put a front, you know, a shim layer on it? maybe architecture doesn't matter so much here. I just want to, again, try to make it relevant for networking applications.
It matters very much. Architecture matters very much. What you're describing is actually not really AI in the purest sense. It's machine learning pre-processing. What happens is as data is ingested, so, okay, SNMP information, streaming telemetry, flow data, they're all different scales and different data types and formats, right?
Yep.
So let's say I get some information that says 66% of traffic on this link is DNS. That's a lot of DNS, whatever. But you have a percentage. Over here, you have link utilization. 80% of this link is 80% overutilized, or rather being utilized 80%. The link might be a 10 gig link. That 80% represents something very, very different. Then you have bits per second that you're ingesting from somewhere. Then you have a threat feed that's literally in like English language, okay? All of this stuff is coming in. Just imagine all the different variety of data and all the different scales. You know, over here you have millions and billions of packets per second.
Sure.
Over here you have a scale of 0 to 100.
I was trying to make it easy for you, just talking about telemetry.
This is really interesting stuff. Oh no, I love this stuff because there's so much value in some of the things that like people like overlook as like that's the simple stuff. But there's tremendous value just in the machine learning pre-processing.
Yep.
We ingest that data, and then we normalize it and transform that data so it all appears on the same scale, usually a 0 to 1 or a -1 to a 0 to a 1, right? But retaining its proportionality. And now the bits per second and the percentage and the flow data and the embeddings that we've been talking about all exist in such a way where they can be inserted into literal math formulas and that you can produce some sort of result, a prediction, new text, a trend, some sort of result that you're looking for. That's how that works. And that's usually one of the initial layers in a multi-layered neural network as part of deep learning, right? You can imagine an input layer and then a whole bunch of layers we call hidden layers and then an output layer, but with the idea that each hidden layer has its own input and output to the next layer. One of those early layers of that network in that feed forward neural network is going to be this machine learning ML pre-processing process where each of those individual nodes is going to grab one of those. And that's the actual math. That's the actual stuff that's happening in all those servers humming away with 800 gig connections talking to each other. Because you got to remember, we are talking about tens of thousands of GPUs acting as one giant brain talking to each other. And like you said earlier, there's a whole realm of technology of how that works that would be a really interesting podcast to do at some point.
Hold that thought. We'll come back to it. Let me slide to another adjacency. The simple generation of configs, I'll put a little bit of a different twist on this. Like you can use ChatGPT to create an iOS config, a Junos config, an EOS config. Even vendors that are not as dominant, somehow the models have been trained on other network operating systems. What would it look like for me to use some kind of LLM combined with a network source of truth? So I actually got the right IP addresses for a given deployment. I know that's not all a single model, but what does that look like from an entire, provisioning system perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're going to do something like that relevant to your own IT environment, you're going to leverage some large language model. I'm sticking with GPT because that's primarily that's the most popular and famous large language model in public use. Certainly not the only one. You're going to leverage that on your back end, and you're going to augment it in with a RAG pipeline. RAG stands for Retrieval Augmented Generation, which is basically this loop of a workflow where you put the query in. The large language model then references that data set of your data in order to produce some sort of result. That data may include all the telemetry that you mentioned, the knowledge bases, your ticketing system, your ServiceNow stuff, your the knowledge base of your devices. So like, if you're running Cisco routers, Juniper router firewalls, things like that. And so it has all that relevant data as well. Use your imagination to kind of see what that could be, what kind of data that actually could be in that data set. It's going to be in that loop where then the large language model, when it answers you in plain English, is using that as its reference, as its source, your IPAM, your CRM, all your application tags and IP addresses are there, all that kind of thing, where it can then produce a very relevant response with the correct configuration, with correct site tags, site IDs, Perhaps it's just real-time information of telemetry. So it can actually answer about like this site is down because this interface was shut off at this time, things like that.
Yeah, there's a whole world to explore there for sure.
That's where we're going. That's where we're going.
We'll find time to do a deeper dive on applications like this in networking and network ops. I think even explore some of the adjacencies with security too, because there's so much that comes from SIEM and other security reporting information that the concepts should not be that different, right? And is there an opportunity here to connect some dots and correlate what's happening, you know, from our security devices along with our network devices and see what's causing what? I think that'd be an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, I feel like the security, network security, cybersecurity industry is farther along than the network industry in that, because they've been doing this kind of stuff for a long time. You know, like just analyzing alerts. You know, you're familiar with alert fatigue because you got some level one SOC.
Sure.
You know, they're sitting there trying to figure out, all right, what's real, what's a false positive. So they've been doing this for a while. And then they'll even do some remediation, simple remediation, where like if this kind of a thing is happening, shut down the port. It's pretty simple. We aren't quite there with the remediation, autonomous and programmatic remediation just yet. It's not that it's hard to do. It's just that we're not doing it quite yet. But I also believe that that's where we're going as we start to see agents being deployed, where the large language model and whatever artificial intelligence workflows you have are able to tap into those agents to actually push config and make changes programmatically.
There's a huge trust issue there in automatic remediation. Right?
Yeah, and yeah, there sure is.
We humans still like to be in the click OK to continue loop. Are you OK with this change? Do you want to take this action? Mm-hmm. And that's not new. Like I've seen that over, you know, a career of, you know, 3+ decades where, boy, this would be so much easier if you could just let go of being that final check, but you want to have sufficient data and runtime proof that the system's going to do the right thing. You don't develop that kind of trust overnight.
But we have kind of trust now with a lot of technologies, don't we? I mean, when OSPF goes from one link to another link, okay, cool. I trust DHCP to give me an address. And if my lease expires, it takes care of another address, whatever, it sends that out. You know, we trust some of the processes and technologies to do some of these things automatically. And some of them are very, very impactful. We have, you know, VMs failing over automatically and things like that to some other data. I mean, we have these things. We want this programmatic and autonomous failover from DC1 to DC2. I really do think that though there is a trust issue, I don't think it's as deep as some would believe. I think that once we see the evidence that the systems, these artificial intelligence governed systems, are making good decisions and not just hosing everybody's network, I think we're going to see a pretty quick adoption of the technology.
Yeah, I love the protocol analogies. Obviously, being a networking guy,
right? Sure.
You know, you don't really build the global internet using static routes, right?
Right.
And we made the little leap from static routes to floating static routes. And then we had this thing called RIP, right? And my favorite is, you know, friends don't let friends configure RIP today. 30 years ago, 28 years ago, boy, you know, what an incredible move forward. And then we decided, well, that's not going to be able to handle real-time protocols like carry a voice conversation. So link state protocols, ISIS, OSPF, right? And then of course, BGP doing very different things to glue different networks, different autonomous systems together. You can even take that into the MPLS world, setting up an LSP. You know, that's all automatic. Right. And we've accepted those things because that just makes sense. Right. Mm-hmm. Why do I want to click OK to continue for these things that we've already sanity checked it and we know it should work? We need that protocol level automation for these end to end process automations. And somehow we have to find a way to apply the trust that we've put into protocols to these other automations that we're trying to move forward in our networks.
So. Yeah, absolutely.
Longer conversation for another time. We will find time to do it. Phil, this has been great. Totally exceeding expectations that were already very high. We have to do the standard. Where can folks find you? Network sure. Phil, how do you want to hear from people and get feedback from people?
Yeah. Well, I'm still very active on Twitter, and it's network_Phil is my handle. Search my name in LinkedIn, Philip Gervasi. I write on my blog, networkphil.com. I also write a whole lot for my company, of course, but there's a lot of my own personal stuff on there. So that's just the Kentik blog. You can search my name. And I really enjoy social media still, so I would love to hear from you.
You can also go to one of the Upstate New York Nugs coming up later this summer and into the fall. And I'm sure you'll see Phil at one of those in Saratoga or Buffalo.
That's right.
I think those are coming up. So,
yeah.
No, really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Phil. And thanks to the rest of you for tuning into Total Network Operations. TNOPS is a living project, and we love your feedback, especially on this topic. AI is going to be something that continues to develop for some time. And as we joked about in the beginning of this episode, we're going to need to update this in 4 to 6 months. You know, who knows what the rate of change will look like. So please give us your specific questions, specific application areas you'd love to, you know, have Phil back and others for follow-up on. This is a research project. This is exactly what we're trying to do with TNOPS. I love being forced to go look at and learn new things. And I love hearing the stories and stretching into all different sorts of tech and topic areas. The goal here is to distill this down into useful information for a much broader audience. So any feedback, any requests, drop me a DM on LinkedIn or send us follow-up at packetpushers.net/FU. Thanks again and see you next time on TNOPS.